I'm afraid that I have some seriously negative news for you. My good friend, and I'm sure a person that you know well, of the Enterprise mission, Richard C. Hoagland has had a very serious, possibly massive heart attack. It occurred Saturday morning, and I've been in communication with all kinds of people since that time. Most recently, his other half, Susan, who works for the United Nations and is presently on her way down to Richard. Richard was stricken Saturday morning with an obvious heart attack, and they called 911 right away. Richard was taken to a local hospital where he is in was in very serious critical condition, is on some form of life support. Give you some idea of how serious this is. He was transported earlier today to a Miami critical care heart facility for probable surgery in the next day or two. Now, that's what I've heard. He is weak to the degree that he cannot talk to anybody. I have not spoken with him. I have spoken with those who are with him. And all I know is it is indeed very serious. Now, there are a couple of things I want to note about all of this. Number one, Richard imagine him gone yet. Richard is 53 years old. He is my age. And while he has led a less than ideal life health-wise, in other words, as you know, he works exceedingly, compulsively long hours. And as you well know, Richard is a serious type A personality. And he probably doesn't eat as well as he should because he's traveling all the time, and so I'm sure it's a lot of fast food. On the other hand, he doesn't carry particularly any extra weight. 53 is a bit early for a serious heart attack of this sort. And he didn't smoke. He doesn't smoke. So this magnitude of heart attack, I think, is quite a surprise, if not certainly a shock. And it is a shock. And I'm, as you well know, Richard is my good friend. Has been so for many, many years. Richard occasionally tends to go out on a limb. However, his science has been quite good. Despite all of the attacks against him, the attacks have mostly been of a personal character assassination nature and have been particularly virulent in the last, several weeks. There are certain individuals who have been without mercy attacking Richard Hoagland and engaging in nothing short of character assassination. Those people know who they are. There is a certain other radio program and website that has been carrying this material. The material generated in many cases by people who are self-admitted liars and frauds. And I'm sure this has contributed to what has occurred in Miami. And then what I would say to those people is shame on you. You know who you are, and the people in the community know who you are. So Richard's condition is critical. He's still in pain. He's throwing up rather constantly. Is very much too weak to talk, and I am led to understand is on some form of life support. Now, there is one other thing to consider. And that is, by the way, I talked to, well, I guess I better hold that. I'm going to refer you back to a letter that I read on the air some time ago. To give you a little bit of background, Richard Hoagland went to Miami, ostensibly not for the Miami Circle. That's something he stumbled into when he was in Miami. But he went to Miami to consult with certain people about the NEXRAD radar images, the weather radar images that appear to show or may show the experimental use of Tesla technology for what purpose we know not. Possibly some suggest weather modification. You'll recall all of that with the turret mount business, all the rest of it. That's why he went to Miami. Earlier this year, when the turret mountain business began, Richard was consulting with a very well-known scientist, a scientist whose name you would recognize. Were I to give it to you, I will not. Richard received a letter from the scientist that I am going to in part read to you right now. And I'm going to let you decide for yourself what it may or may not mean. The letter in part from this scientist to Richard says, quote, "It's this simple regarding the NEXRAD business of the radar. If I wish to live for another, for even 48 hours, I can't go into that or other things or go high profile publicly. I won't do anyone any good winding up dead very abruptly. Bluntly, in my estimation, my own life expectancy right now is about June of 1999, if I'm very fortunate, perhaps only May 1st. If certain others here in the rogue U.S. group have their way, even sooner. That's it. Nothing anyone can do can prevent or affect that. As an old soldier of, and he gives his age, which I will omit, a few days ago, I accept the inevitable. It doesn't change what I have to try to do and what little time I have left. Time for me to do the MacArthur bit and just fade away. Most everyone else may not be very far behind anyway. Nothing you, meaning Richard, or I, or anyone else can do is going to change what's coming down. All the TV shows and radio talk shows and such cannot change one hair's breadth. Only the little nation can avert it, perhaps. I'd give up to a 75% probability, no higher, but would not argue that 50% is more correct. None of the conspiracies, aliens, plots, plans, maneuvering, politics, Clintonistas, rogues, UFOs, researchers, pontificators, intel agencies, armed forces, scientific community, and so forth, have any further effect on any of this. It's really simple. We have a pending strategic strike, unparalleled in all history, now rapidly coming upon us. It's in place and counting down. And the initial preparation period has already begun. At this point, there are only two players in the game, and the U.S. is not either of them. Nothing the entire U.S. can do can change anything at this point, period. Then I'm going to skip down to what is relevant specifically in terms of a warning to Richard. This unnamed scientist goes on, "I strongly advise you," meaning Richard, "to consider also pulling in your own horns on this. In my opinion, the ramparts have already been overrun, and there's no longer any point to trying to defend them. You, too, will not be doing anyone any good if you wind up suddenly dead or meet with a suicide on the way to the supermarket or something." You may recall my reading of that letter. And I am not saying that I believe that Richard was, that an attempt has been made on Richard's life. I'm not saying that because I don't know that to be true. What I do know is that this scientist was scared to death. And Richard was well aware of the fact that he was dabbling in areas that this well-respected scientist considered dangerous to his personal health. So you can kind of pile that onto the news of Richard Hoagland lying in critical condition tonight in a facility with pending surgery. And I don't have more details for you than that at the moment, but that I do know. And I will get you information as I get it. It probably will occur hour by hour. I'll let you know what I find as I find it, but I neither endorse nor dismiss the possibility that this scientist may be correct. I simply submit it for your consideration as I do, you know, everything else. I will tell you this, that one or more than one of Richard's close friends, who are very well aware of all this, had an opportunity to come on the air and declined to do so for reasons of their own personal safety. I would also remind you that there have been others who have recently met with a tragic fate shortly after discussing this technology, this Tesla technology, this scalar Tesla technology as it applies to what's been seen in these images, these radar images. And my attitude is, Richard is a good friend of mine, number one. Number two, I'm tired of the people who have probably contributed to this, if it is not even more sinister, as I just described, with vitriolic, unrelenting character assassination attacks. You know who you are, and I think most of the audience knows who it is, and these attacks have been carried for some mysterious reason by another website and radio program, a reason that I simply cannot discern. Once a person has admitted to being a fraud and a liar, it's unimaginable to me that a responsible broadcaster would continue to give space or airtime to this kind of dribble. There are plenty of areas of scientific disagreement one could have with Richard Hoagland. But the unrelenting personal attacks, I think, are... what's the right word? I think they're disgraceful. And I think they have contributed to this. And I think the people involved should be damned well ashamed for themselves, of themselves. So now you know what I know. You know all I know. If I get any more on all of this, I will be sure and tell you right away. What you might do, and what I would hope you would do, is to do what we have done before when it was really important to do so, and that is to pray. You can use that word, pray. Concentrate on surrounding Richard Hoagland with white light. Pray for him. It's not a bad word. Depending on your belief system, I would strongly advise this would be a good time for all of you to take a moment out and to consider the man you've heard on this program for years and years now, and to concentrate on his healing. Because believe me, he needs it. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. We will be right back. Our nation has only one UFO or ufologist who lobbies in Washington, D.C. His name is Stephen Bassett, and I'm sorry to have to bring him on under these conditions, but from Washington, D.C. Here is Stephen Bassett. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Yes, Art. I'm a little taken aback. I'm going to assume that the information you've been provided is correct and that this isn't some absolute grotesque sick joke.
No, it's correct.
I am disturbed by so many things here that I'm sure we don't have enough time, but let me just hit the highlights. First of all, it troubles me greatly that any individual who has worked with Dick Hoagland or is an associate of his, either just as a friend or as a colleague, should in any way fear to come on your program and talk about him or talk about the issues that he has raised for fear for themselves. If that is true, then it is indicative of anything else I can possibly imagine why this issue must be brought to a head politically and resolved, because clearly there is cancer growing somewhere within our government.
Mm-hmm.
I am not afraid of whoever these individuals are that were referred to by this other gentleman, and I believe there are other people who are not afraid, and that if they're going to take these measures, then let them do so, and they will answer to history. But anyone who is going to, let me put it this way, anyone who makes threats to people in the field, as far as I'm concerned, can just go to hell. Now, having said that, there's something else here that I'm going to talk about, and that's this. For the last 4 months, I watched Dick Hoagland get the living bejesus kicked out of him.
Yeah, I know.
By just about everybody and their dog. And I haven't said much. I think that this is an appropriate time to say something. First of all, I've known Dick for 3 years, and I've spent hundreds of hours talking to him. And I know his faults and I know his strengths, but I know one thing, that nobody that I have ever dealt with in this field works harder and more intensely than he has.
And to be honest, one has to imagine that could have been his downfall. I mean, he just works tirelessly. He will work sometimes for days on end and then crash for 8 hours and get up and work days more.
Certainly at this point, all we have is that a man has had a heart attack who works very hard, and that's all that really should be said. But I think it's not inappropriate to add that at the time that he has continued to work the level that he does, which is 80 hours a week or more, he has had people descending upon him, accusing him of everything under the sun, attacking him from every single direction. And I want to tell you something else. It's worse than that. I've had a number of people approach me in the last 3 months who have made it quite clear to me that if I don't sever my relationship with Dick Hoagland, that I'm not going to get to work with him, or I'm not going to get to do this, or I'm not going to get that opportunity, or I'm never going to have an effect on the field. And I've had the same thing said to me regarding other people I work with. And, you know, the other day I sat down and said, you know, if I sent out a list to all the people in the field and said, please come back with only those people that are acceptable to you to work with, then when all those lists were collected and the names were crossed off, there'd be nobody left to work with. There is a mean, nasty streak that's developed through this field and through the Internet and through the list that is completely out of hand.
There is an orchestrated campaign, I believe, Stephen, nothing short of an orchestrated campaign of character assassination.
Well, I think it's there's an orchestration there, but there's also just an evolving process in which the field has matured, and there's a lot of people who've decided that they have the information and they have the perspective and the credentials and they have the right posture, and there are a lot of other people that don't, and they need to disassociate themselves from it. And therefore, they need to start culling the wheat from the chaff. And so they go on the attack to try to somehow establish a purified position that will then permit the mainstream to accept us, or at least accept that elite group. And what they've done is they've turned into the very people that have been standing at the door of this information for 50 years. They have become, in a sense, their adversaries. And what is upsetting about this is that what this movement is about and what the truth is about and what it concerns is not a group of elite ufologists or a group of special people that have this knowledge. It is about the citizens of the United States,
right,
and the citizens of Mexico and Canada and Brazil,
whether,
and China.
Whether our Constitution and Bill of Rights really means what's written there or not.
It is the citizens of these countries, many of which are completely out of the loop, who have no knowledge of this, who are going to be blindsided by this transition, that whether we like it or not, the people that have spent years at this are in a sense a position of responsibility and are representing these people's interests since nobody else will. And it is about them that this is what this is about.
Steven,
and this endless battle and catfighting and nonsense that goes on amongst the ufologists and the close-in followers is becoming sensuous and debilitating and
yes.
completely forgets that we have a certain responsibility, whether we like it or not, to represent the larger interests of the greater citizenry. And those people are completely out of the loop. And this movement has been a citizen movement from the beginning. It has involved a lot of different kinds of people, some with degrees and some without. And as far as I can tell, and I've studied it pretty well, there are no perfect people in this field. And if I find one, I'll be the first to call you up and tell you who it is.
Yeah.
And there is just no justification for this endless attack, to the extent, of course, that if it is orchestrated as a strategic plan in some degree by members of the government, well, then you could just call it a good ploy in the game.
Well, that is what I believe. In other words, wherever it comes from, Stephen, I see an absolute agenda here. And what I see is, in other words, look, in our field, we have a lot of people out on a limb with McLean, like Richard. Richard's always out on a limb,
mm-hmm.
and that's fine. And extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof or at least extraordinary debate.
Mm-hmm.
And when people come along and debate Richard on his scientific beliefs or findings, then I have no problem with it at all. But that is not what's been going on, Stephen. What's been going on are lies, intentional deceit, and straight-out character assassination. That's what's been going on. And that's not debating the facts. That's not forwarding the field at all.
Let me make another point. And that is that I have sort of an unusual position. I'm not a ufologist. I'm not a researcher, rather. I don't have a body of research that I pursue and I have to defend against all attackers. I'm in the politics. I'm in a representative activist type position. And I've tried to work with everybody that I could. And I have talked with a lot of people in this field, a lot of people that are considered highly controversial, as well as some of the more established hirsute types. And one of the most interesting things that I have learned in the 3 years, after talking with a lot of these people and getting to know them at a reasonable level and understand some of their background, is that the level of misunderstanding that exists in this field between members of the field, in other words, this person thinks that of somebody else, thinks that happened, they did this, they did that, they said this is unbelievable. In other words, 90% of most of the acrimony that goes on and most of the attacks occurs on the basis of sheer misunderstanding. And maybe 10% of it is actually grounded in some sort of fundamental fact that could be established and to create a basis for a beef. The rest is nothing more than misunderstanding. It's like a giant rumor machine and people acting on it without circumspection. And it's extremely troubling to me, because the fact is that when you add all of that acrimony and attacks and personal stuff on top of the pressure that this field generates, and let me tell you, it generates a lot of pressure. When you work 60 and 70 hours a week and you have no money and you cannot take care of your own personal needs, when you can't have family relationships, when you pursue this with very little reward up against a foe that is extremely entrenched, very well financed and very determined, and then you're attacked by people in the field mercifully, it adds to the pressure. And it brings people down. And I've got people that I work with that are in the middle of divorces. I've got people that are failing health. I've got people that are having heart attacks. And a lot of this is self-inflicted within the field. And it's just got to stop. If the people in this country, the tens of millions of people in this country that are watching these videos on television and TLC and NBC and are getting informed to this subject, hundreds and hundreds of hours, they're starting to come to understand that, by God, something is going on here, and it's going to affect us. It's going to affect us in a powerful way. If these people would step forward collectively and say to this field, would you please grow up and would you stop this nonsense? You are the people with the knowledge. You are the people that have done the research. We need you to represent us. We need you to speak to the government, and we need you to stop picking on each other and get with it. If they would do that, it's possible that the people in the field would turn away from each other and toward the subject itself and get the job done, get disclosure out of the way, so we can get on with policy and science instead of myths and subversion and lies and deceit.
And that's exactly what's been occurring. And it, again, if it had been on topic, in other words, if the debate had been on technical issues, whether the issue would be NEXRAD radar or the Miami Circle or whatever else Richard happened to be in the middle of, if it had been on those issues specifically, fine. The field has got to allow for that kind of internal debate.
No problem.
These vitriolic, personal attacks designed to simply damage and leave scorched earth, as you point out, it has got to stop. And the people involved damn well ought to be very ashamed of themselves, as far as I'm concerned.
And it's somewhat exacerbated by the fact that some of the elite people in the field don't even feel they want to sully themselves by addressing this. In other words, they want to try to stand apart and let us all beat ourselves up while they can hold that high ground, when, of course, there is no high ground. All right, this is a citizen populist effort. The reason it is because there are no universities that will participate. There are no government agencies, the military, nor intelligence. There are no institutions at all, including the media in appropriate fashion, that will step in and support it. So therefore, it is populist by nature. And therefore, it is a little ragged, and it's rough around the edges. But I don't know of anybody in this field, certainly nobody that I would associate with, that don't have some fundamental traits. Namely, they want disclosure. They want the truth. They're willing to work hard for it. And they're going to willing to do it with the resources that they have, the degrees, the intelligence, the skills. And they make mistakes, and they approach it from different parameters. But with respect to Hoagland, the one thing that always impressed me about him is that he was brutally frank. He never, ever hedged.
Always.
If he thought something was this way, he called it that way. He was extremely aggressive in his thinking,
yep.
And he was extremely intense. And rather than think of Dick as an asset in the sense that Dick is going to go pursue things and look at things and put things together and maybe go places you would never go and then garnish from that something of value and use that, instead of treating him as an individual that takes that aggressive approach, he had to be destroyed. He had to be brought down because he's corrupting the field. The one thing I learned when I spent some time at Pier, which is the group that John Mack, and I was there when the Nova special came out. I was there when some of the attacks that he was under really intensified.
Right.
Is that the one thing I learned is this is not a fair game. It is a rigged game with an unbalanced playing field. There aren't enough degrees. There is no college you can graduate from. There are no prizes. Pulitzer's, Nobel's. There is not enough accolades that you could ever accrue that would give you full credibility in the eyes of the mainstream. The moment you are in this field, you are fundamentally ghettoized. They have created an intellectual pogrom around this, and we are all the same. And then they stand on the walls of this ghetto, and they look down upon us and watch us fight among ourselves and say, boy, have we done a great job. John Mack had every credential you could possibly have, and they tried to destroy him. And so for us to attack each other over our approaches or our mistakes or some chink in our positions is wasteful, it's destructive, and it completely plays into the hands of those people in the government that are determined to keep the public out of this issue until they are ready, whenever that is, God knows when. And until we decide to put an end to this, this is going to go on. There's going to be more heart attacks, more divorces, more illnesses, more cancers, more God knows what. And it's simply ridiculous.
Steve,
I'm sorry to get upset, Art, but I really am upset about this. I guess Dick's illness has just brought it to a head. But believe me, Dick isn't the first person to suffer in this way. There's going to be more, and I just had to speak my mind on it.
I appreciate it, Stephen. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
You take care. That's Stephen Bassett, our nation's only UFO lobbyist in Washington, D.C. And, you know, I've been very close to Richard now for years as a friend. And Richard, like everybody, has some Achilles heels. He in some ways, has never grown up. He's always kind of childlike. His excitement has always been kind of childlike, and frankly, as far as I'm concerned, a great asset. But, of course, that kind of personality leads sometimes to jumping into things that you ought not jump into. Getting into something too soon, or even being wrong. And he's been wrong, and he's admitted he's been wrong before. However, He's also been down a lot of very good roads, the most recent one, the Miami Circle, as you well know. And maybe some dangerous roads, to include the images that he was pursuing when he went to Miami. And so I will leave it to you all to decide what has happened to Richard Hoagland. All I can tell you at this hour is he's had a massive heart attack. He is in rather critical condition. He's on some form of life support, and he's facing open heart surgery of some sort. As I get details, I'll get them to you. Coming up at the top of the hour,
with Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nigh. 702-727-1222. And you may call Art on the wildcard line at area code 702-727-1295. To reach Art from outside the U.S., first dial your access number to the USA, then 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM from the Kingdom of Nigh with Art Bell.
Good morning. Richard Hoagland has had a massive heart attack in Miami, for those of you joining us this hour. He's in critical condition. I just learned that he's facing surgery in the morning. And I'll try and get you details as they become available. The latest, he is going to be in surgery in the morning. He's in a heart center in Miami. I'm getting, obviously, a lot of communication. For example, Art, Philip J. Corso, Stephen Schiff, Speaking With, John Holliman, even Stephen Greer, who has cancer. Not to forget his assistant, by the way, who has now passed on because of cancer, Ms. Adamack. And now Richard Hoagland. A lot of people, Art, die or get sick in a year's time. But not so many people with the same cause. Mathematics will tell you it couldn't be a coincidence. I'll pray for Richard. And in a strange way, maybe all of Richard's research is being confirmed to him at this very moment on something of a different plane than we can understand. I hate to say it, Bart, but the evidence is building. And a lot of areas tells me, my logical mind, that is, that the war is on. And we have no idea what it's all about and where it's coming from. Or this one. Hi, Art. What happened to Richard today brings up a question in my mind and perhaps others out there, that who will follow in your footsteps if something happens to you. I can almost hear what you are thinking. Right. You can. That's Leo in New Jersey. But you know what? At the end of the day, it is my view that life is short anyway. And who wants to go out in a wimpy style, right? So whatever needs to be said is going to get said here. So I'm very sorry to bring you that sort of news. Somebody else, Joan in Seattle, writes, wasn't it Gordon Michael Scallion, or was it Stan Dale, who said that those with pacemakers and or heart problems should take care on Friday, March 5th, due to the kind of electromagnetic energy that would be flying around? Yeah, I recall that. Somebody else asked, where can we send a card to Richard? At this point, I'm not going to give you anywhere to send anything. And I certainly don't want any facilities in Miami bothered with the thousands of people, well-wishers. And I understand that you would like to send something. So as soon as I'm able to get information on where you can send it, I'll give you an address. And in the meantime, what you can do is pray for Richard Hoagland. As you know, I am perhaps a little sketchy on the source of the power, but I have no doubt at all that mass mental concentration, prayer, if you will, does have an effect. And best we can do is try. So if you have an extra moment in your busy schedule, Richard could sure use your good thoughts, your white light, your prayer. Whatever it is you believe, if you send some good thoughts to Miami, it certainly won't hurt. So there you have it. Coming up in a moment, we're going to change gears because we have no further information at this moment to give you about Richard, other than again to say that those who have been attacking him recently have played a part in this, in my opinion. And those attacks have not been on his work, have not been on his science, but they have been of a vitriolic, personal, tear them apart kind of nature that smacks of an absolute agenda, and I think that those who have been doing it and those who have been giving either airtime to it or web space to it really should be ashamed of themselves. Attack the science, if you will, not the man. And those attacks, no doubt, have weighed heavily on him and had some effect on all of this. So there you have it. Any updates, and I'll get them to you immediately. Coming up in a moment, Kevin Ryerson. commercial interrupt us. But you noticed, now it's to the point where I'll begin to make a comment, and I'll look up and I'll notice that I still have one commercial to go and shut my mouth just barely in time. So maybe that's an improvement. I don't know. Kevin Ryerson. Kevin Ryerson. Kevin Ryerson is an acclaimed author, award-winning consultant, expert intuitive, and a trance channel in the tradition of Edgar Cayce and Jane Roberts. He's been lecturing and teaching in the field of parapsychology and spirituality for 27 years. He's been a guest on national TV shows, including Oprah, Good Morning America, author of the landmark book, Spirit Communication, The Soul's Path, Shirley MacLaine's best-selling books, Out on a Limb, Dancing in the Light, and It's All in the Playing, highlighted Kevin's intuitive abilities. You'll recall he's a good friend of Shirley's. He was both a consultant and talent in the ABC TV miniseries, Out on a Limb. His abilities are also featured in the 10th Insight, Holding the Vision, Experiential Guide by James Redfield and Carol Adrian. The Channeling Zone by Michael Brown, Your Sixth Sense by Bell Ruth Knapperszak, I believe it is, and Time Life's Mysteries of the Unknown. I'm sure I slaughtered a couple of names there. Kevin is well known and respected for his balanced and integrated world view. He maintains a consulting practice in San Rafael, California, and I think right now he's off in what was Richard Hoagland territory, New Mexico. Welcome to the program, Kevin.
Thank you.
Great to have you. You are pretty good friends with Shirley MacLaine, are you not?
Yes. I like to think I have that honor, yes.
Just before we get into what you're doing, what is Shirley doing? It's been a long time since I've heard anything at all about Shirley MacLaine, and maybe you'd be the right guy to update me.
Oh, I think I can do it rather succinctly. Shirley continues to have her long-range interests in many of the subject materials you explore here on the program. In particular, she continues to have a very refined interest in extraterrestrial intelligence.
Really?
Yes. Most definitely.
I know that, Kevin, she was really big on OBEs for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really big on OBEs. And I've done a lot of research into OBEs. And I did it for a long time. And then suddenly, without warning, I had one myself.
Fascinating.
The damnest thing in the world. And so it would be very interesting one day, I think, to be able to speak with her, and I bet you'd be the guy who could arrange it.
You know what? I can certainly pass it on to her. You guys can sit around sort of like swap out-of-body experience stories.
It really is true. It really is true. And I must say, when I first heard about her and Out on a Limb, I was skeptical. Even during the times I was researching OBEs, I was skeptical. And I remain skeptical up until the moment that it happened to me in Paris. And then, of course, a skeptic becomes an experiencer.
I think there's a new category we need. Rather than believer or skeptic, we need that term experiencer.
That's right.
Added to the catalog of terms. Absolutely.
Well, all right. You consider yourself and intuitive, and I frequently interview, and not long ago interviewed Gordon Michael Scallion and many others, and Gordon uses the same word, intuitive. Why do you use that word?
Because the word intuitive means, according to Webster, direct knowing. It means direct knowing that bypasses the conscious, rational, critical process. And when people come to intuitives, they've almost exhausted all of the
logical or rational means to approach their problem solving. So when they work with an intuitive, we're by no means the method of last result, but it's a proven method used in everything from science to everyday decision making in order to make breakthroughs into the human condition.
Again, you said it's a knowing, which would seem to me to be kind of like saying an experiencer. In other words, what you know as an intuitive is not something you're guessing at. It's something you have hard information about from some other level.
Yes, it is. To the point where I myself have worked with persons such as Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove, who you had on the program, I believe, a little while back,
yes,
discussing the Ted Owens phenomena.
That's correct.
I've also worked with Dr. William Kaut, who was a senior staff research scientist at SRI, one of our largest think tanks. And he had put together the method that was referred to as intuitive consensus. And he would actually work with ongoing research at SRI in areas such as earthquake triggering mechanisms, areas such as exploring at the time what AIDS was. We were able to develop, before science had been able to confirm it experimentally, that AIDS indeed was a retrovirus, that it was the protein coding that altered and not its interior DNA, as well as even a methodology for treatment that is now standard in the field in a form of a trifold antiviral approach because of the nature of the ability of the AIDS virus to adapt. So intuition and the intuitive consensus can be applied in a very, very practical manner for generating knowledge or generating information that is then in turn verifiable by the more standard means of science.
Kevin, I want to ask you a general question. Going back to Nostradamus or Edgar Cayce or Jane Roberts or yourself or Gordon Michael Scallion or Danyon Brinkley or other intuitives, is there any common thread that one might explore that you see between all of these intuitives? Is there any common thing that seems to be true of most intuitives? Is there anything that links them together?
Well, I would suggest that the common denominators with intuitives are, for instance, Michael Brown examined the whole phenomena of channeling in his book called The Channeling Zone.
Mm-hmm.
And what he noticed as the common threads were that, one, all the intuitives, even though they came from diverse cultural backgrounds, different varying levels of education, all seemed to present a continuity of a very similar worldview, if you will, sort of a common direction that humanity is taking. And above all else, even though the intuitives may have had very broad demographic backgrounds, they all seem to have a very intense desire to sort of improve the human condition through the use of their gifts, in particular when their gifts were at their peak ability.
Mm-hmm. Danyon Brinkley is an interesting case because I know Dan personally. I should tell you, you talk about channeling, and perhaps we ought to have a little conversation about that. I have always, Kevin, been shy of channelers, and the reason that I've been shy of them is that, not that I think all channeling is bunk, which is what some people conclude from my comments, but I've always felt that it simply allows too much room for fraud. It seems like anybody, I could apparently sink into a trance right now and become Borg from the 17th century with important information for modern day Earth. You know, and so I've always been just cautious about channeling.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that very reason, simply too much room for fraudulent activity. But on the other hand, I don't reject channeling totally either. So
mm-hmm.
Do you have any comments?
Well, I don't even feel I have to wax defensive. Some of the arguments are perfectly legitimate. And That's why I would point out, for instance, that Dr. Kautz had developed what he called the intuitive consensus method, where he might confer with yours truly and a number of other very gifted people.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that where we had consensus with our intuitive insights, no matter what the vehicle, whether it was channeling or conscious clairvoyance or even novel uses of phenomena such as remote viewing.
Sure.
Or, quite frankly, art, even astral projection.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Whereby he felt that where we were in consensus was where the high level of the information was. Now, there's other elements that go into it. For instance, Edgar Cayce is probably the best documented psychic of the 20th century. And just the sincerity of his personality and the longevity of his particular career brings sort of impeccability to him, and he's in many ways he's like the litmus test for many intuitives. Other intuitives do work where they try to, for instance, they document the historical backgrounds of the entities that speak through, which then have implication for survival in the afterlife, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that, like any good consumerism, it's those intuitives who try to, if you will, create a community of individuals and then associate themselves with some of the more credible folks in the field, whether it's Dr. Kautz or the ARE. Those are the people who I think you can more or less rely upon, who have put themselves past the litmus test involving the issue of whether it's real or whether it's Memorex.
Real or Memorex. When we look at futurists, in some cases, Cayce did that kind of a work. Or we look at the Gordon Michael Scallion types or yourself. I interview this wide range of people, from Ed Dames in remote viewing and many, I guess, just about every other remote viewer. Short of Ingo Swann, I need to get Ingo on. I've talked to everybody else. Or whether I'm talking to Gordon or I'm talking to Danyon or I'm talking to so many others. Lori Toy is yet another. I could go on and on. I, too, find a commonality in what they believe. Some of them present the information in hard, scary form. Some are a little New Agey, and they suggest that, well, yes, there are some big earth changes that are pending and are upon us soon, but that it will be an uplifting spiritual experience for humanity. And they sort of ignore the fact that several millions, if not billions, will not be uplifted at all. They won't be around at all if these earth changes occur. And so there are sort of two approaches to disseminating the information, even though it seems kind of common. What do you have to say? Do you foresee earth changes coming?
Well, I think we're amidst swimmingly right now, seeing a great deal of the fulfillment of the Edgar Cayce prophecies. The core prophecy being what I call the Atlantean phenomena, where Cayce was as a social prophet, linked our dependency on technology to this specific period of time, where there would be a crisis in the ecology. And if you look at, of course, the issues of global warming, if you look at unusual phenomena like El Nino, if you look at the abuse of different technologies, such as the dependency on things that expose us or make our culture vulnerable to things such as Y2K, that is all very, very much as though that we are souls from Atlantis, once again coping with the issue of our spirituality, our consciousness, and our flat-out dependency on such things as technology.
All right, Kevin, that's a good place to leave it. Hold it right there. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. My guest is Kevin Ryerson. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. A special message. Back now to Kevin Ryerson. And, Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Kevin, you sort of got up to a discussion of really Y2K and our technological dependence, and that we were probably, according to many people, in for a bit of a fall. Do you see that as the Y2K looming business at the end of the year?
I'm of the opinion that it's an authentic concern, and
yeah, so am I.
And I think in particular things in the medical industry, communications, and of course anything that's associated with military tie-ins are a concern. Now, fortunately, apparently some of those issues are being addressed. From my own sort of like consensus process, it appeared to be that one of the concerns would be is not as though that a collapse may occur universally, for instance, but more so that this particular bug may continue for some time past the January 1st deadline when it's supposed to kick in. I have been working with some people on what they feel might be one of the solutions if they can get the man hours to more or less bring about the programming, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things that probably will be the most sensitive is the grid systems. In other words, the power.
Electric power.
City.
Yes.
Exactly.
I have in front of me something entitled Y2K, What Can You Do or What to Do from the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services. And it's very interesting. They give the background of Y2K. Suggest people begin preparations, talk about water storage, food storage, cooking, heating, refuse, medical care, you just mentioned that, banking, communications, transportation, portable generators. I mean, they cover the whole thing, and so there are a lot of credible sources, including the U.S. Senate now, who are beginning to say things like the Americans should begin to take some prudent precautions for Y2K.
I think that's a true key. I think my own approach to it is not only in response to Y2K, but the implications for the, you know, the human community in general is that it is not a bad thing to necessarily have this type of preparedness for several reasons. One, there have been a number of different disasters that have hit already, which I saw sort of fulfillment of the Casey prophecy, such as the 89 quake in San Francisco,
right.
Heavy quakes that had occurred in Los Angeles, and even such things as El Nino bringing in, you know, mudslides, et cetera, all of which can cripple any one of the different communities.
Kevin, you mentioned global warming.
Yes.
There was a story airing on CNN over the weekend about Greenland. And they've been doing about a 10-year study on Greenland, and they are scared to death. The ice is retreating in Greenland at a frightening rate, they have just determined. They checked it about 10 years ago, and then the year after that, and there was a little bit of a decrease, but then they just now checked it again, and the retreat of the ice in Greenland is frightening.
It is, because this in particular goes into the Edgar Casey prophecies, and even were things that Carl Sagan had expressed concern about. So every now and then some of these two camps can come together and form a consensus.
Every now and then.
And the bottom line is that I wish humanity had started acting on it, taking it a lot seriouser, even, for instance, even as Edgar Casey began to speak about it, because we had identified trends in pollution as far as early as the 50s, for instance, when the formal studies on smog began. And one of the keys is that people, for instance, who in Los Angeles were prepared when some of these wildfires hit and when the earthquakes hit,
mm-hmm.
and people in particular, say, of religious values such as the Mormons, with the enormous stores of food and preparedness they had, that when they did go off the grid system, which is a more common phenomenon than we acknowledge,
yes.
They weren't up there in the hills, you know, protecting themselves like some group of survivalists or something. They immediately had the supplies to break out where they could help their neighbors, and they could help cope with crisis
mm-hmm.
that our government is encouraging us to have this kind of preparedness, which is, in my opinion, the more humane approach to this entire process.
I have never, during my lifetime, heard our government officially tell Americans to prepare by storing food or whatever it is they're saying American people should be doing right now. I've never heard that. Now, I'm sure during the war there were such proclamations, but I was born just after the Second World War, so I've never heard that from our government.
It's more localized, quite frankly, in communities that, you know, take the brunt of these things all the time, earthquake preparedness, hurricane preparedness, and they have never developed a national policy with the exception of FEMA, which unfortunately is more like a paramilitary solution. And, you know, this retreat of the ice is, it's one of the key signs. It really puts such things as Europe, other coastal cities, et cetera, in jeopardy. And when you have things like El Nino, or when you have things like these extraordinary rainfalls where virtually the entire Mississippi River had reversed its course because it couldn't handle the swelling of its tributaries, including the Ohio River, which I'm indigenous to Ohio, was absolutely extraordinary. And once again, as a nation, we're able to recoup, we're able to recover. But I just find it extraordinary that with this kind of unfoldment and these kinds of climate changes, that just community preparedness on a universal standard and universal basis, which we know can be so helpful when nature does become chaotic and we happen to be in the way of it.
Okay, well, that appears to be what's occurring right now. Nature appears to be getting chaotic. The jet stream, I read another little piece yesterday about the jet stream virtually touching the ground. They've had some incredible winds, which can only be accounted for, according to the weather people, by the jet stream virtually touching ground. And that's not all. We've got birds flying north that should be flying south. We've got birds dropping dead. We've got birds with deformities, frogs with deformities. We've got school children down in Australia who are required by law to wear hats because of the amount of ultraviolet radiation, because of the ozone hole. We've got a lot going on with the environment that is not good. I said this on Larry King the other day, and I've said it on my program, Kevin. In the old days of piston engine aircraft that crossed the Pacific, about halfway across the Pacific, because of the amount of fuel they would carry, a little red light would come on that would say point of no return. That was in the old High and Mighty with John Wayne. And in my opinion, humanity's little red light came on a while ago. I mean, that means that you cannot go back. You're only going to go forward to your destination, or you're going in the water, one of the two, but you're not going back to California. And I think that humanity's little red light came on a while ago, point of no return. So the world is not going to end, but I think we're headed for some kind of a change, and I'm not even an intuitive.
Well, I think that many intuitives can agree with the position that what it is that humanity cannot go on in the manner that it has, and the idea that the little red light comes on is an intriguing metaphor. Carl Jung, who underwent a personal transformation by out-of-body experience, by the way, and it became a real core in his psychology, used to monitor the dreams of his patients, and in them suddenly began to appear extraordinary visions of some type of global catastrophe, that eventually he felt that the world had reached a point where the phenomena that came to be known as World War II was something that humanity had almost chosen to impose upon itself, although it had opportunities, if you will, for a sea change or a course correction. His final contributions to the field were twofold. One, he began to examine the phenomena of UFO sightings when they were first beginning to occur in the modern era around between 47 and 49 at Mount Rainier. And he felt that that was hopeful, in that if people have those types of visions, it's as though humanity's consciousness is reaching out and trying to come full circle, in that we are reaching another level in our conscious evolution. Yaber also issued a cautionary note saying that there will come a time when humanity will have to face a crisis that supersedes even the destructiveness of war. This will probably be a crisis that will occur in the ecology that humanity's actions are accountable for. And that perhaps the thing that is hopeful in that is that it may very well be the moment in which humanity will finally be united.
Well, I think, Kevin, we're kind of like the lobster in the slowly heating water, and only some now are realized. The great majority there are sort of people. That's just what we are, you know, not in total, of course, but a majority of the people don't have time to sit back and think about the larger ecological picture, for example. You know, they don't have that time every day.
Mm-hmm. Well, interestingly enough, acknowledging these particular scenarios, and we can even look at the past at other civilizations as sort of precursors as to what's going on with humanity, I also think that there's a phenomena of intervention on the part of what we might refer to as that that there is a spiritual process or a spiritual intervention, and I begin to see what I have come to label as the Jonah phenomenon. Jonah was the prophet in the Bible, in the Judeo-Christian Bible, who, although a reluctant prophet, went and prophesied the fall of a city. And yet the people in the city had repented the points that Jonah had pointed out about the quality of their lives. And Jonah, who was in a profound meditation when he returned 90 days later, thought that he had failed as a prophet because the city still stood and did continue to survive for a number of centuries.
Hmm.
But God speaking to Jonah in a classic biblical sense, of course I'm paraphrasing, really sort of explained to him that he may have been the only successful prophet in the Bible in the sense that prophecy and prediction is so that humanity and human beings may have the opportunity to generate this kind of course correction that we're talking about here, that if that red light has come on, and I agree that may indeed be the case, you know, are there things, inner sciences or in human behavior or human phenomenology that maybe says that we can create a sea change here, or as Bucky Fuller said, is there a trim tab there that can bring the ship state around?
Well, I refer to Gordon Michael Skyen because I respect him greatly as an intuitive, and he has said to me many times that indeed prophecy is exactly as you just suggested. Most times it's not like you could lay all your money down on whatever an intuitive might say, because it might be getting served up as a warning to produce some sort of spiritual reaction that would produce a course change. However, of late, even Gordon Michael Skyen has been saying that the visions he's been getting now appear to be irrevocable and irreversible, and that at some point you do get to a place where what's going to occur is going to occur, and all you can do is perhaps lessen the degree of the occurrence, but not stop it any longer once it has passed a certain point, or the little red light, however you want to think of it.
Right. That agrees very much with what we know from physics, in the sense that it's almost like Schrodinger's cat, where it talks about that because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, we can't know where a particle is exactly in time and space without its losing its mass. You know, is it a wave or a particle? And in the experiment with Schrodinger's cat, he wanted to demonstrate that by putting a cat in a box with a Geiger counter and a toxic substance, and kind of like in a Rube Goldberg-like way, the Geiger counter triggers and spills the toxic substance, but the box being sealed, and we're not knowing exactly what is occurring inside the box on a quantum level, he is able to create a thought experiment that demonstrates that inside the sealed box is the cat is both alive and is both dead, and that not until we open the box and make an observation can we really tell which of those two competing probabilities has occurred within the specific time and space of that container. And I feel that we're reaching that critical point of observation for the planet as to which of these different competing sets of prophecies and predictions, or as they call it in science, probability fields, is more or less coming into manifestation.
Kevin, from your own intuitive abilities versus what you have studied from others, how am I going to phrase this? Do your own intuitive abilities generally agree with the consensus?
I have participated directly in studies where we have mapped a multitude of different trends, a number of which I spoke to before. For instance, AIDS rising in prevalence, of course, is a classic concern, because when you're speaking into an apocalypse, AIDS is certainly one of the more prevalent ones threatening the human population.
Yes.
And it, perhaps it's even a good model for what we're talking about, because it is certainly present. It still continues to increase.
Listen, Kevin, I got news the other day that presently, as of now, one in eight residents of Africa have AIDS.
Mm.
That's one in eight infected with AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's not a reversal, that continent is virtually going to die. There are going to be certainly portions of the continent that are going to be barren. Barren. No human beings.
It sounds like Nostradamus' predictions about the depopulation of different countries. And, you know, it's indeed, when you ask me about my own intuitive abilities, we have been able to trace exactly these kinds of trends, which they sound remarkably like the trends that are in the classic book of the apocalypse, the Revelation. You have pestilence, you have earthquakes in diverse places, you have the issue of war and famine continuing to, you know, to plague humanity, sort of draining its human resources that maybe it could be putting into the solution.
All right, we've got a break here. We're at the top of the hour, so you get a good rest. When we come back, a lot of intuitives lately have been talking to me about our sun. I want to ask about that. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Why baby your baby? Because your baby deserves the best chance at life. I'm News 3's Madeline Holland. Getting proper prenatal care early will help get...
But first, from the Buffalo, New York News, the 7th March edition, March 7th, that was the day before yesterday, now in most time zones. On Tuesday, this went out, by the way, to the Knight Ridder newspapers. On Tuesday, a dangerous asteroid whizzed by Earth in a cosmic close call. Several near misses are expected on March 18th, March 26th, and April 1st. Astronomers are discovering potential killer asteroids now at a record pace. The public's flirtation last year, remember, in the movies? With fear of menacing space rocks fueled by two fictionalized movies and one very widely reported threat, has now faded. But the threat has not. Astronomers scanning the sky with new technology are finding substantial, fresh evidence of real danger. They are almost weekly additions to their list of potentially hazardous asteroids. In 1998 alone, scientists found 55 of the would-be killers. More than the previous 6 years combined, now the list is at 163 and growing. So, as is usually the case, you always get it just after it's happened. On Tuesday, we had a close encounter, they say. Well, if on Tuesday it had hit, we obviously would have had no warning. I would jog you again with that. Kevin, welcome back.
Okay.
I have had a number of intuitives, some remote viewers.
Mm-hmm.
Who have been telling me that our sun, for some time, has been the focus of a lot of their attention, and that they expect something pretty rough pretty soon from our sun. Have you heard anything at all about this from anybody?
I've heard over about the last 24 months concerns about everything from the sun's magnetic field to increased sunspot activity, to a possible increase in solar flares, et cetera, et cetera. There's a concern that maybe the sun's magnetic field is somehow becoming more unstable, almost reaching some type of zero-point effect, where it may release higher amounts of radiation than usual, which,
correct,
with the with the Earth's already battered ozone layer, per se, that... I don't think it would be the equivalent of a coup de grace, but it would be something to be definitely concerned about if this is then confirmed through other sources, other, say, astronomical sources.
Well, we are entering, in the next couple of years, a solar maximum. And, of course, we go through 11-year cycles or 22, depending on what you believe. The full cycle is 22, but every 11 years we go through a cycle with the sun, and we are about to enter a maximum. But a lot of people seem to have concerns about the Earth's magnetic field. They see it beginning to occasionally wobble and change a little bit, and there's quite a substantial body of theory out there, Kevin, that should our magnetic field collapse or radically change, and the sun should have an ejecta, that virtually Israeli scientists, for example, believe the dinosaurs were not killed by some great rock that hit Earth, though that's certainly possible, but rather that the planet was virtually instantaneously sterilized by radiation from the sun, and that there are catastrophic circumstances that occur from the sun from time to time. Now, that's not frequent from our mortal point of view, but it might account for a lot. And so I guess you've been hearing these things as well.
Yes. It doesn't wander too far afield, for instance, from the Edgar Cayce prophecy.
That's correct.
Before our sciences about magnetic fields were even developed. In fact, if anything, you can trace the roots of his prophecies, some of which was the most famous about the Earth flipping on its axis, or the wobble in the Earth's axis continuing.
Mm-hmm.
It was not only the Earth's physical position shifting 6 degrees, it was specific references to the Earth's magnetic field that he was also addressing. So this has roots in classical prophecies and predictions with Cayce, and was considered one of the key precursors as to when we'd be entering into these times that we're conversing on now.
Mm. Is it your sense that we are close?
I think that we are, Art. And to me, the thing that fascinates me about this is again what I refer to. If we've reached that halfway point, what types of means of intervention is going to occur here? If, as Jung said, there is this crisis in the ecology, as I pointed out, what I called the Jonah phenomena. You know, are there factors that can somehow moderate or modify? I think what we're in consensus on is a crisis point as we go into this, this new millennium. There's cycles in nature. Above all else, humanity is destabilizing the ecology. What I am curious about is what are the trends that people like Jung and Cayce spoke to?
Is there
might be a moderating factor in this?
Is there, in your opinion, Kevin, really any significance to 2000? I mean, certainly when you consider the computer problems that may lie ahead, there's no question about it. But otherwise, the year 2000 is just another day. Really, it's just there have been shifts in the calendar through the ages, and I don't think January 1st, 2000, the world is going to end, even though people march up and down the street with signs saying so. It's just another day, really. Or is there some spiritual significance to it aside from Y2K?
It's with Y2K, you just have a classic botch of humanity trying to rob Peter to pay Paul, trying to save a little bit of extra bite on computers, that then in turn just grows out, like when you have that 16th inch of a carpet. When you lay it down, all of a sudden you got 4 feet going up the other side of the wall.
Sure.
But the year 2000, or quite frankly, the idea of the millennium, does have its roots in the concepts of the precession of the equinox. And with the precession of the equinox, you have a more than subtle shift of where the sun rises, for instance, in 2,000-year cycles, far as the
can you explain
progression
that?
Astrologically, where the sun rises in the spring, fall, and winter equinox and solstice. So there is, if you will, a significant astrological and astronomical relationship that does occur in 2,174-year cycles.
Huh. 2,174 years. Can you explain that so I can understand it? I know what the solstice is, spring and fall.
Mm-hmm.
But the procession, what do you mean by that?
Well, if you It's really one of the things that makes an argument for esoteric civilizations such as Atlantis. For instance, the Sphinx, where Casey refers to as the Hall of Records being, which he sees as a hope for humanity to be able to cope with these radical evolutionary changes that are occurring on the planet. The paws of the Sphinx are positioned exactly in alignment as to where the spring equinox would have occurred approximately 15,000 years ago.
Gee, not just 4,000 years ago. Did you happen to see the special on Fox with the opening of the tombs with Zahi Hawass, Dr. Hawass?
Yes, yes, yes.
And I'm sure you heard Dr. Hawass. I have Dr. Hawass on tape. I was standing right at the back of the Sphinx with Dr. Hawass, and I had a video camera going. In fact, I should get that tape out and play it. And Dr. Hawass adamantly, just as he did in the Fox thing, said, "There has never been art. One grain of sand," said Dr. Hawass. "Not one grain of sand that would lend any proof at all to the whole Atlantis concept or the fact that this is any older than we believe it to be. It was done by Egyptians' art." That's Dr. Hawass.
Well, I could agree with him that it was done by Egyptians and Atlantis and Atlanteans per se. So you're not really, if you will.
You wouldn't say Atlanteans.
I would have to point out that you're not. There's a lot of pride on the part of indigenous peoples as to their accomplishments, and I don't think that you're demoting indigenous peoples by acknowledging that it may have been intercooperative with other cultures. And quite singularly, the geology of the Sphinx confers upon it a greater age. Even the ARE's radiocarbon dating of the pyramid made it at least 1,000 years older than the oldest dates that they have for it.
Yes, I know.
And they were dating mortar, it suggested they were dating a repair to the pyramid that had actually been spoken of in the Casey predictions.
And all of this causes Ayahuasca to go straight through the roof whenever you mention it to him.
Yes. He's a great storyteller. I mean, he looked great as kind of an Indiana Jones there when he was crawling around in the tombs and stuff. I admire that kind of diligence.
Oh, he's hard to follow. I chased him around Giza myself and almost had my own heart attack. Now, watching that little gal and others chase him around was kind of humorous. Reminded me of when I was there. You're right. He's kind of an Indiana Jones kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you this. If he made, this is my own personal belief, and he'd really take me on for it, but if he made a discovery of really earth-shattering significance, trust me, it wouldn't be on Fox.
I would have to agree, because the very tunnel that he spoke of that remained unexcavated, that he kind of courteously acknowledged, you know, when being challenged, the fact that everything that he has discovered, that he's speaking of as his greatest discoveries and his greatest adventures, was described in intimate detail by Edgar Casey some 50 or 75 years before.
That's right.
Is rather extraordinary.
Well, indeed, they have, through a penetrating X-ray, they have discovered that there is a tunnel that seemingly leads down at an angle from the Great Pyramid toward the left paw of the Sphinx.
Yes.
And
furthermore, there appears to be a chamber there where it's been suggested that when when the spring equinox occurred, and it would have aligned exactly between the paws of the Sphinx, it would have been just below the horizon line of the constellation Leo and the constellation Virgo. So it appears that the Sphinx is the equivalent of a star map. And in one of the legends, it talks about how Ra gave humanity a secret place, just below the place of the lion. And it's believed that if you look at that as a star map, because the Sphinx is a precise profile, in precise profile is exactly that. If you connect all the dots in the constellation Leo, it's the precise profile of the Sphinx. So looking at that as a star map, it's the idea of what is called the Hall of Records and a source of hope for humanity in these challenging times is right below the Sphinx, where they have done these non-invasive forms of archaeology using ultrasonics and x-rays, et cetera, et cetera. And they have confirmed there is indeed a chamber there.
What do you believe the pyramids are?
I believe them to be a very unique technology. We have gone to the pyramids multiples of occasions. I've traveled there myself with a group called Power Places Tours. I'm returning there with another group called the Intuition Network this September.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to be exploring some of these issues. I believe them to be a type of what you might call a psionic type of technology that had a multitude of different functions. I believe it to be the equivalent of what you might now call a database in stone. I believe the way to access it is through intuitive states, and that the pyramid itself and the extraordinary mathematics associated with it, for instance, if we were had to send a single object into space to communicate with extraterrestrials, I believe the mathematics of the pyramid would probably communicate more about our planet than virtually any other type of object.
So you were suggesting it is kind of a machine of some sort.
I think it is indeed a technology. The term machine, conjures up images of Newtonian mechanical universe.
It does. So, most loosely used.
Yes.
Are you aware that December 31st at midnight, Dr. Hawass is going to replace the gold capstone on the Great Pyramid?
You know, I have this comedic image that he's going to do that, and then suddenly, like, the Hall of Records will open up right underneath his feet when he does that.
I know. I'm trying to decide whether I'd like to be there or not. Hold on, Kevin. We'll be right back to you. Kevin Ryerson is my guest. This is Coast to Coast AM. All right, back now to Kevin Ryerson. Kevin, you said you were in Egypt at Giza. Have you ever had the opportunity to go to the top of the Great Pyramid and lie in the sarcophagus?
Yeah, multiple of those occasions. In fact, we even had the opportunity to work under some instructions with the pyramid as the kind of technology that we spoke of before, with some rather startling results.
Would you share those?
Certainly, if you like.
I would like, yes.
Well, we started out in the base of Egypt, where going through the temples, which many people feel line up with the chakras in the human anatomy, and the climax was actually entering into the pyramid itself. Now, through my own intuitive process, it had been predicted that if we worked appropriately with the energies in the pyramid, we could have a demonstration of what was called climate control as to how the Atlanteans had worked with it. So we had taken instructions to work with certain ancient Egyptian hymnals, which break down into certain types of sound frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
And when actually lying in the sarcophagus and then causing it to resonate by striking the side of it with your fist, it resonates to a perfect pitch of A. And it's like a great drum. And then with the other types of meticulous types of chanting, quite similar to the kind of chanting that is done in Tibet, a rather remarkable phenomenon occurred. When we had entered the pyramid, the sky was perfectly clear. When we had come out of the pyramid about an hour or two later, as we were there to be able to be there privately, because it was after the park had closed, the plateau had closed, there was an extraordinary thunder and lightning storm that was entirely out of character with the climate at that time of the year. And later on, as we viewed from the Weather Channel, the eye of this thunderstorm that was directly over the capstone of the pyramid itself.
Uh-huh. You know, if Dr. Hawass was here, he would say, Kevin, what a wonderfully imaginative mind you have. I've spoken with Dr. Hawass so much, I know exactly how he would respond. I got to lie in the sarcophagus and myself, and I had an experience that I still really can't properly put words to. I felt something that resonated within every cell of my body, and that's about as close as I've been able to come to explaining to people what I felt as I was there. I did it kind of humorously. I first laid in there and kind of crossed myself as though I was a a dead Egyptian. And then I stopped laughing and I started feeling. It was really strange. Well, anyway, listen, I've got a lot of calls, so let's see what's on the line, Kevin. The first time caller line, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Hi.
Hello.
Hello, hello there.
Mr. Ryerson.
Yes.
I'm an aspiring young yogi here, and during my practice of the yoga, it's actually led me back to the Bible,
mm-hmm.
God. And I was wondering, your intuitive powers, are you using yogi or the chakras, calming of the quiet, quieting the mind with the use of yogi, or how are you doing this?
Okay. Well, the description of yoga, many people feel is actually contained within biblical scripture. For instance, Jesus uses the root word yoke on multiple occasions, even saying, put upon yourself my yoke, or the yoke of the Christ. And the word yoga itself is derived from the term yoke, meaning to link the mind, the body, and the spirit, which is exactly parallels Jesus' teachings. Furthermore, he spoke of the importance of the body as a temple. He spoke about how the kingdom or the order of things is within the body.
Right.
And my own intuitive process interprets the book of Revelations as a book of yoga, that the seven churches and the seven candlesticks and the seven seals are the seven chakras. And that as those energies are opened up, people reach either individual potential or they reach the collective potential that then becomes the fulfillment of the prophecy that the book is associated about. So yoga is very much part of the intuitive development process.
Wow. All right. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Hi.
Hi. Good morning, Art. This is Greg in Elkhorn, California.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to say how sorry I am about your friend Richard.
Yes, sir.
And I'm going to be sending a lot of positive energy his way.
Thank you.
There are some great mentions of Richard's work in your book, The Source, too, which I really liked a lot. Kevin, how are you this morning?
Excellent.
I have a question that kind of relates from a topic that one of Art's guests had discussed, the late Speaking Wind, who I have a lot of respect for.
A Native American who was on my program, who spoke a great deal, by the way, about weather modification, who had himself a massive heart attack and died.
Yes, sir. But speaking, what I'm referring to is that Speaking Wind had mentioned that there would be an amount of Great Depression which would be caused by possibly, correct me if I'm wrong, Art, by the alignment of planets. And it leads into my question, which is this, Kevin. Do you have a take on our nation's young people and the hopelessness, which I believe would be led to by depression in this day and age, that they do feel? And because of these feelings of hopelessness, the terrible acts that they do act out upon at times because of these feelings?
Mm-hmm. Well, part of what I think that we need to include in, you know, programs like these is, you know, is some of the patterns of hope that can emerge for the future for young people, because these are very trying times, not only for us veterans who've been around for a while, but in
sure.
particular for the forthcoming generation.
They sure are.
And one of the hopeful trends that I point out is that one of the most one of the most advanced spiritually, in my opinion, one of the most rapidly growing schools of thought in the world is the private school movement of the Waldorf schools that have been founded by Rudolf Steiner, who was sort of a Judeo-Christian mystic contemporary of Edgar Cayce. And people who find that when they put their children in either these schools or open them very early up to their fundamental spirituality,
yes.
that these become almost like whole new human beings, and that they're extremely resilient, and they're able to resist, you know, some of the types of peer pressures that are put so much on children in our urban centers. And that, to me, is a very, very hopeful trend. And I think that as, you know, we continue to make progress, and maybe as this kind of information gets out there, and one of Art's largest constituency is both 20-somethings and younger folks,
sure.
They kind of have Art Bell parties listening to these kinds of things. And so maybe we can reverse some of this kind of conflicts that exist in our society.
That would be nice. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Where are you, sir?
I'm in South Bend, Indiana. This is a filler. Can I ask Mr. Ryerson? See, for a while, I've been listening about 5 years, and I was thinking about, an ABC suit, that's atomic, biological, and chemical. And now I've been thinking about maybe I could buy a NASA space suit I don't mean to be flip about this, with air conditioning and all that to, negate the radiation and whatever else might come my way, just for survival purposes. And there's so many potentials with, like up in Canada, they found a species of butterflies that only existed in, Midwest America.
Well, it is a little...
Canada.
Sir, it is a little flip in the sense that if something happens to the environment that is really serious, if you have a spacesuit, you have an extra few hours.
Well, Art Bell said it might be a few days. Or not Art Bell, I mean Ed Dames. I'm sorry, Art. Ed said this might only last a few days that the temperature is going to grow up drastically. I think our greatest threat is from the volcanology that's occurred in the past, which, by the way, I'm pretty well read, and I've heard that some of the dinosaurs died, mainly from the earth upheavals, about 15 to 28,000 years ago, according to Casey. And that's something to think of, too. I mean, you think it killed dinosaurs. Well, there's been volcanic eruptions over in Africa that released cyanide gas, I believe, or certain sorts of dioxide gases.
Well,
the
whole issue of volcanology and the changes that are occurring, although I think you said it with serious intent, one of the things we do have to point out is that because of the lowered human immunology, there are people who are living in spacesuits on a daily basis because they are so sensitive to these radical abuse of the ecology,
right,
in the form of these kinds of earth changes, these really deep volcanic changes, which are probably occurring due to the earth's warming. And there are people who have to live their lives on a daily basis in some type of containment suit or containment chamber because they have absolutely no immunity to these radical events in the ecology.
Do you think that there has been an overall lower... Do you think that there has been an overall lowering of immunity systems worldwide?
I think that is a very, very well documented trend. I think that's very well medically accepted. I mean, if nothing more than just the stress of modern living, which we know lowers the immune system and the T cell counts. But furthermore, because of issues like AIDS, this is for the first time that we have really recognized this as a crisis in humanity. But one of the things that's also intriguing is that it does appear that humanity does respond to these kinds of stresses because with the mapping of the human genome, they have noticed, for instance, that there are certain peoples who have almost what are like dormant genetic qualities that are now beginning to emerge that maybe is somehow a genetic reversal of some of the stresses that have been placed on the human system. One is a group of people, for instance, who can actually synthesize vitamin C, and that apparently is existent in all of our genetic pattern, but it is part of the dormant gene pool.
Kevin, do you see that as the continuing process of evolution?
I do, and that's why I actually am. That's why I'm hopeful that even as Jung said, there's this crisis in the ecology. It's the fact that we are getting larger and larger audiences of people to begin to look and to cause shifts in their thinking. Human evolution in relationship to the environment was well documented by people like Jeffrey Goodman in his book We Are the Earthquake Generation.
Yes.
Where he studied the climate changes out here in the southwest where I'm at, the ancient Pueblo people and the Anasazi people, and found that when humanity was at a high spiritual point with high psychic activity, the climate reflected a real abundance of food and resources, and the human population expanded. However, when they abandoned those principles, it's almost as though the climate responded in kind and basically extremely harsh droughts, earthquakes, then displaced these very, very highly evolved spiritual civilizations.
Mm-hmm. There's something that a caller said that just haunts me and haunts me. And so I'm sorry if I keep repeating it to my audience, but a caller called me and said, hey, Art, it's like Earth is getting mad at us. And I thought about that for a second. I said, no, Earth doesn't get angry. Earth gets even. And even that implies some sort of consciousness, which I'm not so sure about. But what I think is, Kevin, that when we put nature out of balance, the Earth itself, its environment, its ecosystem, its closed system, simply responds to correct that balance. Now, a casual observer might think Earth is getting angry at us. But she's not really getting angry. She's just sort of restoring a balance.
I would 100% agree with that statement. Rupert Sheldrake's what is called morphogenic field theories, or the idea of the Gaia effect, is that the idea of the Earth as a living organism is receiving a great deal more credence nowadays as we look at this crisis in the ecology. And even biblically speaking, it says, you must keep the laws of the prophets, lest the Earth itself spew you forth.
Well, what do you say to right-wing religious fundamentalists whose view is that the Earth and all that is on it was put here for our exploitation, our use, and that politically, as you well know, there is a large movement in this country to debunk at all costs anybody who might talk about changes that we need to make to begin to make corrections in our environmental situation. There's a very, very strong political lobby against anything of that sort.
I totally agree. There's there is an attempt to repress what I consider some of the more progressive type of thinking that could lead to a much more hopeful scenario if it comes out and becomes part of the mainstream values. The Institute of Noetic Sciences has done a hopeful demographics of what appears to be an emerging demographics of what is called the cultural creatives. These are people who draw their values, for instance, from what they consider to be authentic in relationship to the ecology, authentic in relationship to what they see working in our democratic institutions and want to bring about massive reform, and that they're in juxtaposition to the more traditionals who draw only upon fundamentalist religious belief systems. So they trace the demographics that this is about 35 to 45 million people,
yep,
voting age, and that they, but what they need to do is to become more conscious of themselves as a demographic force. So they're, in addressing the issue about right-wingers and stuff, first of all, humorously, I'd like to go on the record that in spite of Mr. Falwell's best statements, I don't think that Tinky Winky, for instance, is the Antichrist. I did take offense at the, you know, at some of the anti-Semitic implications in some of his statements. But
he's been making some absolutely remarkable statements lately. I mean, just things that blow you away.
It is rather remarkable, and I think that what it is, it has to do with the fraying of that particular demographics as, that they have run the course of any ideas that they may have had per se, and that there is a new demographics emerging out there. And if it can have these kinds of effects, that newly emerging demographics that Jeffrey Goodman was able to document so excellently, perhaps we ourselves have reached a crisis that the ancestors have known about, whether it's the Anastasi or whether it is the builders of the pyramid, that the past maybe is the precursor to the future, and that we have something to learn from those ancestors.
Well, I want to lighten up on my statement a little. There are many in the religious community who view what's said in the Bible as a mandate to be good custodians of what is here.
Yes.
Which is very different, but there's a large radical group, unfortunately, that is pushing politically with some great success to subvert any attempts at change to correct the environment, and that's who I was talking about. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Art, yes, this is actually, I'm east of the Rockies, but your east of the Rockies number doesn't work up here north of Toronto.
So you got through on the West of the Rockies line in Toronto.
Yes, actually.
That's really interesting.
That's resourceful.
North of Toronto, yeah.
Yeah, whatever it takes, you made it. Do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Ryerson.
Yes?
I was just wondering, what is it like when you have these, like, visions, or is it like an apparition? Does it come to you in a dream? Is it just a... feeling that you get?
A subtle feeling or a specific vision, Kevin?
Well, in meditation, it can be a specific vision. In particular, if you form a question first, which is like what the Socratic method says, is that if you form the right question, more than likely the right answer is already within you. And through meditation, you have the ability of forming a very specific inquiry, and then you have an episode of direct knowing. Now, I'm a practitioner of what's called Anja Yoga, which it is the belief that the mind or the intellect can be an equal tool for bringing together the spirit and the body. So in my particular case, I am experiencing what's called a conscious clairvoyant episode, it is like a very clear, comprehensive body of knowledge that I did not necessarily take into the rational critical process.
So in other words, it's not a fuzzy concept you're plucking from what you're feeling. It is an absolute knowing.
It is comparable to Einstein's insight of seeing light or his theory of relativity as a horse coming down on a beam of light. And it just took him 10 years to work out the math.
There you are. All right, Kevin, hold on. Are you good for another hour?
Oh, hey, I'm ready.
All right. Kevin Ryerson is my guest. This is Coast to Coast AM. He has a good deal. Faster connections. Anyway, back now to Kevin Ryerson. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you.
And lots of people want to talk to you, so here we go. First time caller line, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, sir. Where are you?
This is Dawson in Memphis.
Memphis.
AMWREC.
Of course.
And Kevin, you were talking about the... Oh, by the way, this call is dedicated to Richard Hoagland.
Thank you.
you were talking about the precession of the equinoxes.
Yes.
And it being 2,174 years.
Yes.
Okay, in Graham Hancock's book, Fingerprint of the Gods.
Yes.
He said, in order to make the math work that the ancients had planted in mythology all over the world, the figure 2,160,
mm-hmm.
mainly because it's divisible by 9, and it made their math easier.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that number 2,160 has also been hidden in Genesis?
I have heard quite a number of different frameworks of reference on that. Jim Hertak, in his book The Keys of Enoch, in conversations I've had with him, has made mention of this.
What happened, Joseph Campbell, they were running a PBS program, and he mentioned that a German scholar had worked the math out for the Great Cycle in the Patriarch's Ages, and he didn't give any specifics. So I sat down, I took a look at it. And the Patriarchs, as you know, have very long ages anyway. And Enoch, having lived 365 years, that should be a clue that it could be some hidden math in there anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But I found out if you take the all the patriarchs to when they begot their sons,
mm-hmm.
And add it up, you mm-hmm. get 1556.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now you have to add another 100 years in there because it's 100 years further till the flood. And Graham had said the precession math is very often hidden with flood stories.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That'll give you 1656.
Mm.
Now, let's see, I want to follow what I've got written down here. You have to multiply this by Enoch's total age, which is 365.
Mm-hmm.
You get a total number of days.
Mm-hmm. It would
be 604,440.
Mm-hmm.
However, you've left out leap year days.
Mm-hmm.
You take the 360 degrees of a circle, which all this stuff is tied with, add that to it, you get 604,800.
Mm-hmm.
To get weeks, you divide it by the 7 heavenly bodies that we name the days of the week after. This will give you 86,400. And you divide this again by the mnemonic, which is the 40 days and nights of the flood, and you get 2,160.
All right. Well, I appreciate that information, but my reaction to that is that, boy, oh boy, you can make any number happen if you have enough reference points and you can name enough things and you can make any number mean anything. Now, I don't mean to take anything away from what he just said, but sheesh. I could take Bill Clinton's birthday and Monica's date of birth, and before you know it, I could end up with, I could date the pyramids or something or another, right? Any comments on all that?
I think the idea of sacred mathematics is fascinating. Like I said, Einstein, you know, saw the whole theory of relativity as a horse coming down a beam of light, and then he knew that he could use the speed of light as a universal standard. But even now, we know that the speed of light, perhaps in new mathematics, using some of the theories of Tesla, can perhaps be superseded and may not be a universal standard at all. So
that's right.
Even what we consider to be standards in physics itself that we base our sciences on has some flexibility. But one thing we do know is that in relationship, for instance, to say some of the sacred math proposed by the pyramid, is that just the division of its height to the measurements of the base
Absolutely.
Does begin to derive some of the numbers that he was mentioned contained in Genesis. So mm-hmm. it's rather intriguing.
All right. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Hi.
Yes, hi, Art. This is Karen in Houston.
Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have several points in the Casey material I'd like Kevin's special perspective on, if I could.
Go.
All right. Casey mentioned at one time that the original fall of man was in the realm of spirit, and that later what came in the flesh came after that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he said like attracts like.
Yes.
And in 1998, the Christ consciousness would return here.
Mm-hmm.
And in a dream, he interpreted himself as returning here by the end of this present century.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me anything about these?
Well, just to clarify a little bit, he talked about how originally, you know, we were in spirit, and then that we are really spiritual beings. In other words, our origins are as beings of energy or consciousness. And that we are here as spiritual beings to experience the physical, that we're not physical beings trying to be spiritual. This is all, of course, contained within the, you know, within the basis of Genesis before. But in the simplest form, it's the idea of souls we have incarnated through reincarnation, as expressed in Hinduism and Buddhism, that we are evolving our consciousness towards a point where we become aware of our own spiritual potential. And that in one of the Casey readings, it was suggested that this return of what we call the Christ is a collective awareness of our own individual and humanity's potential to become children of God, which simply means that if God is love and that is what we are, that can be one of these more hopeful paths that we have in this period of testing that Casey talked about, that we've more than alluded to earlier in this program.
Mm-hmm. All right, and as far as Casey himself returning by the end of this century?
Edgar Casey, in his classic vision, saw himself as a young man sometime between 1999 and possibly the vision was as late as 2015, as being in some type of craft. It sounded remarkably like some type of technology associated with extraterrestrials, and he had his classic vision of the Earth with the Earth changes that, again, we discussed in some detail earlier in the program. Now, whether or not that means that he is physically incarnate, or whether that means that as a soul he was viewing the planet's direction or fate based on the predictions he was given, is still open to some interpretation.
All right. And Art, lots of love to Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson and Art Bell. Hi.
Hi.
Where are you, pray tell?
I'm in Texas.
Okay.
I would like to send you some pictures, Art, of some ancient building stones.
Well, you can do that by mail or email.
Which are from, I think, the original Atlantis. These stones are, giving you an example, the heaviest one is 750 cc's.
Where are they located?
It's somewhere near Texas. That's all I can say now. 750 cc's, and they weigh 5 pounds and 6.5 ounces, and they're man-made stones.
Okay.
I'll watch your mail, and I'll get a set of pictures off to you.
All right, I'll look forward to that. Do you have a question for Kevin Ryerson?
Yes. In the Atlantis, the research that he's done in Atlantis, does he have any estimate as to the age of the Atlantis?
Oh, do I have any estimates?
Yes.
Well, in the channelings and in most esoteric histories, you must remember Atlantis had several phases to it. The classic Atlantean period that Casey addresses, which culminated around, say, about 10,000 to 12,000 B.C., places that classic Atlantean period is around 25,000 years. But before that, Casey traces the history of Atlantis back at least 240,000 years, and then traces the precursor civilization of Lemuria back almost 1 million years before that. And we do now have some anthropological evidence suggesting very, very, very advanced achievements on the part of humanity, and perhaps even much more advanced concepts of humans, human evolution dating back to those periods of time.
That would fall under the category of forbidden archaeology. And there certainly is a lot of it. In other words, there have been a lot of finds made that don't fit into what archaeologists and scientists believe about us, and so they just sort of, when they find something like that, they don't present it. And the people who do present it generally suffer loss of their careers. Are you aware of that?
Definitely. There's intriguingly enough, even traditional anthropology is being put under a lot of pressure. A fellow intuitive of mine, whose name was Abrahamson, actually had pressed back the arrival of humanity here in the North American continent by some almost 25,000 years by a classic site found as Flagstaff, and he was sponsored by Jeffrey Goodman. And that is now actually accepted as the new carbon dating as to the how long human beings have been here in the North American continent.
Hmm. All right, west of the Rockies, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Top of the morning to you.
Hi, this is Kathy. I'm calling from Palmdale, California.
Hi, Kathy.
And how are you doing tonight?
Well, it's a rough night, rough day, but...
I'm sorry. Things will get better. They always do.
So it is said.
Yes. I do have a question about the pyramids.
Yes.
And I do have a second question, also unrelated.
Okay. Go ahead.
First of all, do we know when the gold top was first removed from the pyramids?
You mean when was the capstone lost?
Yes.
It's interesting. It's been suggested that that it may have been there as late as some of the early Greek influences. There are recordings of it and descriptions of it. The other thing is that there were descriptions that there may have actually been not only the gold capstone, but other types of capstones. One suggested being made of lapis, and perhaps one made of quartz. But it appears that it may have actually disappeared fairly late within the historical game plan, being there as late as around the time period of the birth of Jesus.
Ah.
And we do know that most of the limestone was stripped off during the building of some of the mosques by the Islamic faith.
And in replacing this cap, do they feel that... the pyramid is going to do something so-called turn into a machine and do something, or no one has any idea, things not being said?
I think that the gentleman who's putting the capstone on looks at it as strictly a pleasing sort of aesthetics or a pleasing type of sort of publicity stunt per se. I mean, it has a dignity to it because it's kind of cool that it'll be up there again.
I kind of liked your earlier answer. Somehow I envisioned Zahi going up there and finally placing it on top of the pyramid, and all of a sudden you hear this giant rock shifting and sand pouring. Yeah, something begins
and it's
to
like suddenly the Hall of Records blazes to life.
Right. Then my second question, very quickly. I have a very good friend, Margaret, And I've known her a little, almost a year.
Yes.
And our relationship has grown very strong, and it's very funny because it doesn't scare me. I find it very interesting.
What doesn't scare you?
A lot of times our thoughts are the same. We'll be watching something or listening to something, and we will blurt out the same exact words at the same moment.
It's called synchronicity, or perhaps something else. Who knows? We'll try and address that if we can. Synchronicity is in itself a fascinating topic. Kevin Ryerson is my guest. You might get a pencil and paper, because I'm going to give him a chance to promo anything he wants when we get back after the break. He's been such a good soldier. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. Have it. Back now quickly to Kevin Ryerson. No, wait a minute. I've got to get my break done, don't I? If I don't do that, they get very, very upset with me. I'll get out a pencil and paper because Kevin Ryerson, I'm going to try and get him to promote whatever he would like. Storable food. Let me promote that a little bit. Y2K, weather changes, whatever you want to consider. I would say that storable food is a good idea. Our Senate says it. The California Governor's Office of Emergency Services says it. Just about everybody is saying it. And my sponsor, J. Michael Stevens Group, that sells storable food with shelf life of 10 years or better. They sell food that is not foreign sourced. They sell food that is in containers that do not leak. They sell nothing but quality food. They're in Salt Lake City. That should tell you something right away. They, too, would urge you, if you cannot afford quality stored food, which they sell, then store food anyway. Do what you can, but do it. In other words, do your own investigation, if you wish into Y2K, and I think you will come to your own conclusions about what you should be doing. And time is now getting short, so you better get to doing it one way or another. If that way is to call J. Michael Stevens, they'll send you free information on what they have. The number is 1-800-377-000. That's 1-800-377-0700. Give them a shout, even at this time of the morning, and the information will come down and intellectually chew it over and decide what you're going to do. Again, the J. Michael Stevens Group, if you're thinking about storable food, think about J. Michael Stevens. 1-800-377-0700. My newsletter is called After Dark, and every month it's chock full of interviews, current news, analysis, photographs, illustrating, and expanding on many of the things you hear me talk about on both my shows, Coast to Coast and Dreamland. And in each issue, I put some of my more poignant thoughts on paper for your perusal. By the way, After Dark is not one of these little photocopy deals. You know, three or four sheets of white paper and a staple in the upper left-hand corner. No, no, no. This is a full-blown magazine format on slick paper with lots of color throughout. If you like my radio program, I know you're going to love After Dark. To order, call toll-free 1-800-917-4278. That's 1-800-917-4278. After Dark. It's the definitive chronicle of nighttime radio. That's it. I think you'll enjoy it. They're making leaps and bounds of improvement in the newsletter, and it really is getting very, very sharp. So if you would like After Dark, call 1-800-917-4278. Now, Kevin, you've been such a good soldier tonight. Do you have a book or an email address or a contact piece of information that you would like to give out or promote?
Sure. I'd like to inform people that, one, they can reach me at my website, which you graciously had put on your own there.
Of course we have a link, yes.
And it's www.kevinryerson.com. We update that all the time. People could write me if they like at ryerson at excite.com. And we constantly update programs, and if people wanted to, they could reach us personally and get a voice at the other end of the line at 415 356.
Wait a minute. 415. I'm getting a lot in a short time here. 1-415.
415-356.
Right.
9887.
9887.
And we could then update people on various programs that we're doing. I like the term Think Globally, Shop Locally.
yes.
Is a program that I'm doing with the organization of which I'm on the board of directors of. It's called the Intuition Network. Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove, who you had on the program, is mm-hmm. the president of that. And we are taking a group of people to Egypt in September, and that's with Power Places Tours. And that would be one of our global events. And people will have that opportunity to experience private time inside the Great Pyramid in the very sarcophagus that we were speaking of before. They can explore what their own sensations would be. I'm personally taking a group to Scotland in the summer months. And we will be basing out of the Findhorn community, which to me is exciting because I look at it because it's famous for its gardens with its flowers that grew in winter. But I like to think of it as a community that its architecture was built by angels. And we're going to be going to megalithic sites very comparable to Stonehenge. As to the shop locally, I encourage people to really look for the resources in their own community. In my work with Shirley, one of the things that Shirley was most excited about of what now has become sort of like a New Age icon was the Bodhi Tree in Los Angeles, which mm-hmm. has now become a major resource community. And I encourage people to just look for what Buckminster Fuller called those trim tab in their own community. The trim tab is that little rudder that turned around the rudder that can bring around the whole ship of state. Just in Santa Rosa, California, I just made an appearance at a wonderful little store. It was called The Opened Heart, and the people there, for instance, are very, very dedicated to a lot of the principles that we're talking about in turning around, you know, some of the types of events that we're talking about
yes.
and trying to get people in touch with their inner resources.
All right, and again, your email address, we should spell it for people in case they don't know how to spell your name. Your email address is Ryerson, that's R-Y-E-R-S-O-N, at excite.com. Ryerson, R-Y-E-R-S-O-N, at excite.com. All right, back to the phones we go. First time caller line, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson and Art Bell. Hi.
Good evening, Art and Kevin.
Hello.
First time, hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay, yeah. I was on my cell phone, so I thought I might have went out. I have a question for the guests. First of all, I want to say I'm praying for Richard, and the world's a much more interesting place with him in it.
Yes, it is.
And, okay, I guess my question, I'll try to make it, I'll sum up the story quick, and it's a question for your guests. But in the Old Testament, there's a story where Abraham cut some cattle and some different animals. He, like, cut them in half, and then he went to sleep, and a darkness came over him. He was really afraid. But then a smoking pot flew through the pieces, to sort of sum it up. And I always sort of thought that maybe if there's a connection between cattle mutilations and maybe UFOs, where what the smoking pot that flew through the pieces that Abraham cut up was maybe what he thought was God, and maybe the cattle mutilations today are a sign that maybe of some sort, similar to what he did. And I wonder if your guest has ever... thought anything about that, or if he's ever heard that, or
all right, well,
any further.
Sure, let's ask. Cattle mutilations are a modern phenomenon
mm-hmm.
that has certainly not been answered.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a fascinating interpretation, and certainly there's no lack of arguments, some of them quite well made, that events, you know, seen in the Bible could be easily interpreted as, close encounters of the multiple kind. In particular, mm-hmm. the most impressive to me is, of course, Ezekiel's wheel, which, when studied for its aerodynamics and its interpretations, makes a rather remarkable argument for such contacts being made by ancestors. I look at what we call the cattle mutilations. If you look at them as almost more like surgical explorations on the part of... whomever may be doing it in the form of extraterrestrials, we have become so dependent, for instance, on this as a main food staple. I could almost see them as sort of taking samples of it throughout all the ages to sort of see what it is that we're doing to ourselves in the form of a major source of nutrition.
Okay. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson and Art Bell. Good morning.
Oh, hi, Kevin. Like you were saying that roughly 13,000 years ago was when the Sphinx was created, and that it aligned with the constellation Leo.
Yes.
And then
Leo Virgo.
Yeah. And that, would that be the? Would you say? And then you said that the Atlantean age was before that time, but sort of ended at that time. Let's see. Like right now, we're entering the age of Aquarius, and then that's 180 degrees from the constellation Leo.
Mm-hmm.
So would we be entering the new Atlantean age?
Hmm. Quite interesting. The precession of the equinoxes seems to suggest that indeed there's a correlation between human behavior and advancements in civilizations.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sphinx, theoretically, according to the esoteric history, would have been built about 2,000 years or so just before Atlantis was finally submerged, according to the Casey readings. And I think that we are approaching what is called the Age of Aquarius. And rather than the Piscean Age, where these things are more an issue of faith, it's the idea that all these types of sciences that we are now discovering and being advanced by people, for instance, such as Richard Hoagland, is that it is now time for us to know these things, that we need to look at these things as psychic sciences that we can practice openly in the society, rather than these things being regulated or held back by mystery schools or like there's some types of psychic industrial secrets.
Oh, like the Age of Aquarius would mean that like the secrets, like Pisces is sort of secretive.
Yes.
And then hidden, and then Aquarius, everything opens up, so we'll be opened up to this sort of Atlantean knowledge.
And I would say that's correct, and I would say that we're pretty much right on schedule, and all we have to do is make certain that we don't go through the same types of errors in allowing our dependence on technology to outstrip our psychic sciences and or our spirituality.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, and take care. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson and Art Bell. Hi.
Hello, how are you doing?
Sounds like another portable call on a cell phone.
Unfortunately, yes. I have a very long drive and listen to you on my drive.
Yes, sir.
I have to admit, I didn't hear much of the show, but I did hear the notions that our actions and our spirituality and our lack thereof affect the way the world reacts, and the world, the earth, and of course its surrounding ecosystem reacts to our actions in those manners.
Yes, sir.
And I don't think that can really be held forth, and for a couple of reasons. One is simply the age of this rock. Too many upheavals, too much history in the earth before there was a spiritual being anywhere near it. You know, 3.5 billion years.
Yes, there's always been change.
Right. But, I mean, and it managed to do it all by itself without us having to, you know...
Can I interject?
Act on it positively or negatively to trigger it.
All right, Pause for a second.
Yes. If I can interject, the idea that there's natural forces in nature, independent of consciousness... I would suggest what you need to do is to examine such things, for instance, such as the Hindu mythologies, where they talk that Brahma sleeps and Brahma awakens, which was approximately a 14 billion year cycle, and that is part of the Hindu creation mythology. And you can't really get caught up in the poetry, for instance, of the 6,000 year epic described in the Judeo-Christian Bible. And so really what you're looking at is not incarnate consciousness, but you're looking at the idea of infinite consciousness in the form of the creative force at work here. And
right,
even Carl Sagan was fascinated with the Hindu creation myth, which he said that if there was a deity at work or a consciousness at work, those indeed would describe it most accurately because it does match what we know about the physical age of the universe.
Right, right. And just, and one other thing, and this is something I'm not missing on you personally or individually, because I believe in conservation and do quite a bit to try to make the world in the pristine state,
mm-hmm.
or as pristine a state as I possibly can. But
mm-hmm.
I believe there's a lot, I guess I would call it on the left wing, of this type of thing on the opposite side of the right-wing religious groups who are saying that you know, trying to pull down the ecological movement, is that I think it's maybe a little on the arrogant side to presume that we can really affect the Earth in any real, in any real significant fashion.
All right, caller. Caller. Hold on.
Yes.
Your point is well taken. There is extremism on both sides. However, I think you are correct that it is arrogant of us to presume that we could destroy the world. We will not destroy the world. It was here long before we began to walk upon it. It will be here, it will be here long after we no longer walk upon it. What we can do, what humanity can do, is to ruin our chances to continue to walk on the Earth. After we're gone, it will continue to go around.
Right. So basically, we're not... I guess it's a terminology thing that kind of grates me a little bit because it plays on the fears that really
I
think your points are very legitimately taken, and believe me, I accept the arguments that you make, in particular about the need of humankind to show a little humility in relationship to the age of the planet, in the sense, you know, that we have been here maybe consciously, even by esoteric history, say about a million years, which is just a drop in the bucket. And
sure
I think that humanity needs to show some humility in relationship to the awesome responsibility of being here on the planet.
And there you are. Well, to the Rockies, you're on the air with Kevin Ryerson. Hi.
Hi. Brother Art, Kevin.
How are you?
In Tucson, Arizona.
Okay.
The Holy Spirit in me bows to the Holy Spirit in thee. I wish, just as a precept here, at the 20-year level of my engineering career, I went out and lived in seclusion in the desert for 7 years. In between, I did go to India and spend two turns of 5 months deep, deep into the Himalayas at the 19 to 22,000 foot level where the illumined master is up around Simla. And additionally, I have been around the world many times. I spent 9 years in the Air Force flying. I've been around the world many times, and so some of these other tours during that seven-year period where I spent with deep, spiritual, mystical teachers in all of major world religions gave me even deeper insights to many things.
Based on all that, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. I was wondering, Kevin, have you ever been to a Kumbh Mela?
A Kumbh Mela? I don't think I've had that honor.
Okay, I think, you know, with your understanding of the Hindu tradition,
mm-hmm.
Every 12 years they have this spiritual festival that is never advertised
mm-hmm.
and held in the Himalayan city of Hardwar.
Mm-hmm.
This is the period of time that the great masters come out of caves, forests, and wherever they may be, and then assemble into Hardwar and to share the teachings and so on with the populace.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all very interesting. We're so short on time. I'm glad it was at least something decent because I was afraid for a second, Kevin, that you were going to suggest you'd never had that that honor, and it might turn out to be a situation where you get placed in a pot and cooked by some locals somewhere. Listen, we are absolutely out of time, Kevin. It has been such a pleasure having you on the air. I want to have you back. I also would love, dearly love, to get Shirley MacLaine on the air.
I'll put in a good word for you. She's currently working on a film, and she's a little busy right now, but as I said, she still holds very, very keen interest in these types of issues we've discussed here this evening.
Well, perhaps when she's done with her film. I usually have to catch authors between books
mm-hmm.
and film stars between films. That's just the way it goes. And I understand how it is when you're doing a film, you're busy virtually from dawn until far after dusk, and it's hard work. Kevin, what a pleasure it has been to have you on. One more time, folks, if you'd like to email Kevin Ryerson, it's simply Ryerson, R-Y-E-R-S-O-N, at excite.com, and you can bet we'll have you back again.
Thank you, Art. I've enjoyed being on the program.
Take care, my friend.
Excellent.
That's Kevin Ryerson, folks. And the age of Aquarius, yep, guess it's on the way. Hope it's on the way. Hope it comes in gently. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
This is Tom Halleck. Is your hair thinning? Are you losing your hair? Are you afraid of going bald? Have you tried just about everything to prevent hair?
You're listening to the Art Bell Show. Art Bell Show on Hot Talk 105.1.
I could read your mind, love. What a tale your thoughts could tell. Just like a paperback novel, the kind of drugstore sell. When you reach the part where the heartaches come, the hero would be me. Heroes often fail. You won't read that book again because the ending's just too hard to take.
Talk with Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye. From east of the Rockies, dial 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, 1-800-618-8255. First-time callers may reach Art at area code 702-727-1222. And you may call Art on the wildcard line at area code 702-727-1295. To reach Art from outside the U.S., first dial your access number to the USA, then 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM from the Kingdom of Nye with Art Bell.
It certainly is. Good morning, everybody. Kind of a rough morning in a lot of ways. I don't know if you have the news on Richard Hoagland.
If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts.
He's had a massive heart attack in Miami.
Just like an old time movie, out of ghost.
He's facing surgery this morning. And we'll keep you updated as best we can, but the situation is very serious. Well, I'll tell you, it's been a rough year or two. So many people that I know. So many people. We're going to do open lines for an hour. Anything you want to talk about is fair game. There's enough news, certainly. Joe DiMaggio, passing of Joe. Stanley Kubrick, gone. I guess nothing is sure but taxes and change and death. Or is that taxes and death? But that's all change, huh? We'll be right back. Stay right there. Would you like to stop the nagging pain of arthritis? A listener, Phyllis from California,